Law and Grace, Chapter 3, Which Things Are an Allegory? The Parabolic Content of the Sacred Narrative. Parables in History. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. With that bare assertion and briefest of preambles, the Bible story opens. And as it begins, so it continues to its close, with a positiveness which brooks no dispute. Scripture everywhere purports to recount the acts and purposes of God, in brief, to speak of him and for him. This it does without either making a formal statement of its right to do so, or giving any assurance that what it records is the absolute truth. It acknowledges no necessity for doing either. Presupposed throughout is a readiness, nay, more, an obligation on the part of the reader to accept its accuracy as beyond reproach, and its authority as in consequence unquestionable. Herein lies the uniqueness of the Bible. It is this which has provoked so many in every age to challenge its veracity, for let its history once be proved false, and its authority is immediately rendered null and void, and its claims upon men's belief and obedience lose all their urgency and relevance. None saw this more clearly than Paul. For him, the entire gospel was a pure delusion if the fact upon which it was predicated was not, after all, a fact. If Christ be not risen, then is our preaching vain. The consequences, too, for his converts were truly disastrous, for the trust with which he had persuaded them to accept it was then wholly misplaced and futile. And your faith is also vain. Moreover, gone was his whole dependability as a preacher, if in this essential respect he had proved to be untrustworthy. Yea, and we are found false witnesses of God, because we have testified of God that he raised up Christ, whom he raised not up, if so be that the dead rise not. He realized that if he were shown to be unreliable on a purely historical issue, he had thereby forfeited the right to speak authoritatively for God on any subject whatsoever. For who dare trust the false witness's word? So it is and must be with the Bible as a whole. Since all its teaching is rooted in history, the authority of that teaching is contingent upon the truth of the history. Both stand or fall together. If the history be shown to be unworthy of the name, to be not a sober record of fact, but simply a fanciful reconstruction of the past, then the teaching based upon it cannot be classified as truth. Its moral laws can then be regarded as mere mundane expedients, intended solely to ensure the smooth conduct of everyday life. As such, their authority is no higher than that of the society which devised them, and might be flouted by anyone disposed to do so with no eternal consequence to himself. To quote Paul again, if the dead rise not at all, why stand we in jeopardy every hour? If after the manner of men I have fought with beasts at Ephesus, what advantageth it me if the dead rise not? Let us eat and drink. Tomorrow we die. Such are the momentous issues, intellectual, spiritual, and moral, implicit in any decision as to the reliability of Scripture. It either enlightens or deludes men utterly. There can be no compromise over that matter by those who understand the Bible for what it is. It is an organic whole, and either its teaching and the historical facts on which it is based are wholly true, or both together must be wholly false. The Bible, then, it must be insisted, deals in facts and not in surmise. Yet those facts are never recorded out of mere antiquarian interest. They are recorded essentially for their significance in terms of spiritual and moral truth, and as a help to the human understanding of God. This is particularly evident in the case of the creation story. The first divine fiat was, "Let there be light." It translated itself at once into reality, and there was light. But its immediate fulfillment did not exhaust its meaning, for the divine command was both literal and parabolic, expressing at once a creative intention and a spiritual purpose concealed within it, and namely that light, in the widest sense of the term, should ultimately dispel all forms of darkness. The simple comment, "and there was light," stands therefore not only as a sober proof that the intention became an accomplished fact, but equally as a pledge that the spiritual purpose involved in it will also as assuredly be realized. It is therefore a confident anticipation of things to come, as well as a sober statement of historical fact. To say with John, "And the light shineth in the darkness, and the darkness overcame it not," that's the Revised Version margin, as Weymouth has it, "The light shines on in the darkness, and the darkness has never overpowered it." God again declared, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." This similarly expressed both his decision to create man and also his motive in doing so. That is, it defined both the nature and the destiny of man at once. The decision became fact, like the others before it. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, yet not in the full sense intended. As far as Adam was concerned, it became true of him physically and mentally when he was formed of the dust of the ground, but through his failure under trial, it was prevented from becoming true of him morally and spiritually as well. Moreover, as subsequent events so sadly confirmed, his lapse involved all his progeny, so that in his one failure, the whole of mankind fell short of its ideal destiny. Yet, the divine purpose was not thereby frustrated. God proved equal to the emergency. In due course, there came into the world the one solitary exception to the rule, his only begotten Son. He, the Son of God, was Emmanuel. He was the image of the invisible God. He, notwithstanding the fact that he also, like his fellows, was involved in the effects of Adam's sin, proved to be what Adam failed to be: God manifest in human flesh. In him, then, after all, the divine creative purpose achieved its due fulfillment, and wondrous to tell, though he was but one single individual, by him the consequences of Adam's failure were nullified for all. For he, being flesh, God, in his infinite wisdom and mercy, with no compromise of his own holiness, was pleased to accept him as the representative and epitome of all mankind. In him, therefore, humanity as a whole potentially realized its true destiny. On the strength of his triumph, we can confidently await the coming of the day when once again the observation will be made, this time with finality. So, God made man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Such is oftentimes the significant character of Bible history. It is both literal and allegorical at the same time. For being allegorical, it does not thereby cease to be literally true, nor, because it is literal, does it qualify as allegory. Does it fail to qualify as allegory? It is properly not pure parable, but enacted parable. It retains its claim throughout to faultless accuracy. It is this which gives it its unique importance, for its allegorical content, precisely because it is immanent in authentic historical facts, possesses the same property of truth as the facts themselves. Thus, its lessons remain permanently relevant, even though the facts which first served to illustrate them belong to the distant past. The law, in particular, provides ample warrant for that assertion. We have already established that its legislation was highly symbolical. We shall soon discover the same to be true of its narrative passages. The law, as we know, was given by Moses. This is only another way of saying it was delivered at a definite stage in time and under certain special circumstances. Indeed, the law clearly indicates as much, for its legislative sections are so firmly set into a narrative framework as often to bear the impress of those circumstances. It will therefore help our later researches if, before proceeding to the detailed study of those sections, we first pause to consider the close interrelation between them and contemporary events. That interrelation is in fact the key to the proper understanding of the history and the legislation alike. We must first isolate the salient facts. They may be enumerated thus. 1. Israel developed into a nation under conditions of slavery in an alien land. 2. God led them forth from their bondage, delivering them from destruction, first through the Passover blood, then through the crossing of the Red Sea, which they afterwards celebrated in triumphant song. 3. From start to finish of their exodus, they were guided by the pillar of cloud and fire, and their basic physical needs were satisfied in the wilderness by the miraculous provision of manna and water. 4. At Sinai, God formally, by covenant, pronounced himself their God and accepted them as his people, and then delivered laws for the regulation of their national life as his representatives on earth. 5. The covenant made, God ordered the construction of a sanctuary where he might dwell in their midst as a token that he was indeed their God, and arranged the establishment of a mediatorial priesthood to minister there. 6. Separating the land of bondage behind them, the land of promise ahead of them, lay the wilderness with its rigors and privations. This they had to traverse if their redemption was to reach completion. How eloquently these facts would have spoken to them as a complete parable of salvation had their hearts not been hardened. Each Israelite was meant to see in Egypt with its slavery a symbol of his natural state as a sinner, in dire need of deliverance from the bondage of sin, to see moreover that he was powerless to effect that deliverance for himself. God alone could effect it for him, and then only on the basis of the shedding of sacrificial blood. Passover had been followed by the passage, under the guidance of the pillar, through the Red Sea to the liberty beyond. So he, conscious that redemption was available to him, had, under spirit guidance, to break with his old life of servitude to sin by a formal act of renunciation, and therefore lead a new life, no longer serving sin. Exulting in the miracle of his deliverance from slavery and death, he was to conceive of his new life as essentially a spiritual pilgrimage, in which God's law was to be his constant meditation, and the spiritual food and drink of God's providing his indispensable daily sustenance as he went forward toward a divinely appointed rest. Therein, as one of God's covenant people, he was never to revert to his old ways, but so to live in conformity with divine law that God might see fit to dwell with him and be accessible to him through the appointed mediator. In brief, the discerning Israelite should have seen in the great historical drama in which he himself was but one of a great multitude of actors an objective representation of his own spiritual life and experiences. The exhortations of Moses certainly urged him to see things in this way. He was not to boast in his physical circumcision. It was but a token of his covenant status, which was enjoyed not on merit, but only in the mercy of God, bringing with it an obligation to realize its spiritual meaning and the leading of a life befitting a member of the covenant people, in which the desires of the flesh were to be consistently disowned. Behold, the heaven and the heaven of heavens is the Lord's, thy God. The earth also, with all that therein is. Only the Lord had a delight in thy fathers to love them, and he chose their seed after them, even you above all people, as it is this day. Circumcise therefore the foreskin of your heart, and be no more stiff-necked. He was to submit cheerfully to the privations of the wilderness journey as a needful spiritual discipline, qualifying him for the privilege of enjoying the rest to come. Thou shalt also consider in thine heart that as a man chasteneth his son, so the Lord thy God chasteneth thee. Therefore thou shalt keep the commandments of the Lord thy God to walk in his ways and to fear him. For the Lord thy God bringeth thee into a good land. His utter dependence for survival on miraculously provided food was to remind him constantly that he owed even life itself to God's mercy and depended on God for everything. That there was a life higher than mere physical existence, and a divine food without which that life could not be lived, and of which the material manna was but a type. And he humbled thee, and suffered thee to hunger, and fed thee with manna, which thou knewest not. Neither did thy fathers know, that he might make thee know that man doth not live by bread only, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of the Lord doth man live. When the vision of the good land ahead was obscured by nostalgic memories of the land he had left, with its material plenty and attractiveness, he was to realize that he could not revert to them without reverting at the same time to the bondage which went with them. To seek to go back was indeed to do despite to the redemptive work of God. Ye shall henceforth return no more that way. Such was the fundamental law. That law, or rather its spiritual counterpart, expressed itself in a variety of decrees. The memory of the cruelty of the bondage which he had suffered in Egypt was to burn itself into his consciousness. Not only was its bitterness to dissuade him from returning thither, it was also to inspire him to noble endeavour. The recollection of that wonderful sense of relief which the break with Egypt had meant to him at the outset was to constrain him to be faithful to the Sabbath laws and to appreciate their purpose. The seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, nor thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thine ox, nor thine ass, nor any of thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates, that thy manservant and thy maidservant may rest as well as thou. And remember that thou wast a servant in the land of Egypt, and that the Lord thy God brought thee out thence through a mighty hand and by a stretched out arm. Therefore the Lord thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day. The Israelite was not to deny to others the rest which he himself had been so grateful to receive. The memory of the cruelty of his former masters should thus restrain him from repeating their injustice against those in his own employ. If thy brother, an Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, be sold unto thee and serve thee 6 years, then in the seventh year thou shalt let him go free from thee, and when thou sendest him out free from thee, thou shalt not let him go away empty. Thou shalt furnish him liberally out of thy flock, and out of thy floor, and out of thy winepress, of that wherewith the Lord thy God hath blessed thee, thou shalt give unto him. And why should this be? There was one simple, all-sufficient reason. and thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in the land of Egypt, and the Lord thy God redeemed thee. Therefore, I command thee this thing this day. How illuminating, once again, is that explanatory comment. God had redeemed them, everyone, from bondage, so they were to confer the same benefit on those of their brethren who were in bondage to them. And in doing so, had not God seen to it that they should come out with great substance? The Egyptians being only too eager to accede to their request to borrow their possessions in the desperate endeavour to hasten their departure on the fateful night of Passover. So they too were to ensure that their Hebrew bondservants went out liberally supplied with every necessity of life. Symbolically, as it were, they were constantly to be reliving the Exodus. In keeping with that fact, the weak and defenceless were ever to be the objects of the Israelites' solicitude, for he himself had known the perils of their position when a slave in Egypt. Thou shalt not pervert the judgment of the stranger, nor of the fatherless, nor take a widow's raiment to pledge, but thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in Egypt, and the Lord thy God redeemed thee thence. Therefore I command thee to do this thing. He had suffered in Egypt, not only as a slave, but as an alien. Never was he therefore to perpetrate the same wrongs as he had suffered himself against any alien in his own midst. If a stranger sojourn with thee in your land, you shall not vex him. But the stranger that dwelleth with you shall be unto you as one born among you, and thou shalt love him as thyself. For ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. One law in particular made pathetic appeal to his own sense of gratitude for the freedom which he enjoyed as a slave liberated from a cruel master. Thou shalt not deliver unto his master the servant which is escaped from his master unto thee. He shall dwell with thee, even among you, in that place which he shall choose in one of thy gates, where it liketh him best. Thou shalt not oppress him. The thoughtful Israelite could not fail to see a didactic purpose in this law. He was to see in the fugitive slave the reflection of himself fleeing from Egypt, and to accord to him the same mercy and protection as he himself had been vouchsafed by God. Apart from humanitarian considerations, any failure on his part to obey was much more than an act of disobedience. It was also an unwitting confession of spiritual blindness. There was always a risk that such blindness might lead to the oppression of a fellow Israelite. This was emphatically forbidden. All Israelites, high and low, rich and poor, were equal in their enjoyment of redemption from Egypt and membership of the covenant nation. None was to forget it, so none was allowed to make a bondman of another Israelite. And if thy brother that dwelleth by thee be waxen poor and be sold unto thee, thou shalt not compel him to serve as a bondservant, but as an hired servant, and as a sojourner. He shall be with thee and serve thee unto the year of Jubilee, and then shall he depart from thee, both he and his children with him. and shall return unto his own family, and unto the possession of his father shall he return. For they are my servants, which I brought forth out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as bondmen. Thou shalt not rule over him with rigor, but shalt fear thy God. Such bondmen were always to be foreigners. They shall be your bondmen forever. But over your brethren, the children of Israel, ye shall not rule one over another with rigor. A foreigner, on the other hand, was not allowed to make a bondman of any Israelite who sold himself into his service. As a yearly hired servant shall he be with him, and the other shall not rule with rigor over him in thy sight. Any Israelites who could were to regard it as a bounden duty to redeem any such needy brother, and thus remove the anomaly presented by a member of the covenant people serving one of the heathen. As for any Israelite who esteemed the privileged status of his brother so lightly as to kidnap and sell him for gain, only one punishment was appropriate. If a man be found stealing any of his brethren of the children of Israel, and maketh merchandise of him, or selleth him, then that thief shall die, and thou shalt put evil away from you. Liberty was the God-given right of an Israelite. Even if his brethren failed in their duty by not redeeming him, that right was safeguarded by his automatic release in the usual way. For unto me the children of Israel are servants, they are my servants, whom I brought forth out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. There was an inalienable dignity attaching to one who had been redeemed by God. Regulation upon regulation served to remind the Israelites of it. Thou shalt not lend upon usury to thy brother, usury of money, usury of victuals, usury of anything that is lent upon usury. Unto a stranger thou mayest lend upon usury, but unto thy brother thou shalt not lend upon usury, that the Lord thy God may bless thee in all that thou settest thy hand to in the land whither thou goest to possess it. Implicit here again, we note as a compelling motive, is the memory of God's mercy to them in taking account of their need when defenceless slaves in Egypt. That memory was to lay even greater claims upon them. Moreover, for once in 7 years, they were also to acquiesce cheerfully in the total cancellation of their rights as creditors. At the end of every 7 years thou shalt make a release, and this is the manner of the release. Every creditor that lendeth aught unto his neighbour shall release it. He shall not exact it of his neighbour or of his brother, because it is called the Lord's release. What had the Exodus been but the Lord's release? So once again the sharp distinction was drawn between the redeemed and the unredeemed. Of a foreigner thou mayest exact it again, but that which is thine with thy brother, thine hand shall release. But having reminded the Israelite of the significance of the Exodus in that negative way, the regulation also brought home to him his positive duty to his fellow men. For what had his bondage in Egypt been but a symbol of his hopeless indebtedness to God as a sinner? His deliverance had thus, in a very real sense, been a full and absolute release from his debts. God had granted him the total pardon of his sins. The ritual of the year of release thus made him consciously realize that he, having himself had his trespasses forgiven, was under the inescapable obligation to forgive in turn those who trespass against him. In every conceivable connection, ordinances of this kind were used as a medium for spiritual instruction and exhortation, teaching, Israel that they were, and therefore should prove themselves to be, the purchased people of God. And in each case it was the reality of their physical experiences that gave both relevance and urgency to that instruction. Even the calamity of war was enlisted for this purpose. The reason for this latter fact is not hard to find, for what were the pursuing hosts of Pharaoh in the historical parable of the Exodus but representatives of the arch enemy of God, sin? Hence the significant terminology of Moses' song in commemoration of their destruction: I will sing unto the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The Lord is my strength and song, and he is become my salvation. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name. The term salvation interprets the allegory for us. God was a warrior bent on the extermination of sin and certain to accomplish it. Each Israelite was therefore to become a good soldier in the service of God who had redeemed him from a living death. Occasion soon arose for the lesson to be brought home to the people afresh. Then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim. Joshua, one who by his very name was symbolic of God's saving power, was appointed by Moses to lead the host, while Moses himself interceded for God's help as mediator. It came to pass when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed, and when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. The coincidence of events spoke for itself. In God's strength only could Israel prevail. And to demonstrate that fact with greater intensity still, the natural strength of Moses' hands proved inadequate to the task, and support had to be given to him by Aaron and Hur. As a result, his hands were steady until the going down of the sun, and Joshua discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. And there followed a very clear hint as to the parabolic significance of the day's events. The Lord said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in a book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Moses later reminded the people of this charge and of the reason for it. Remember what Amalek did unto thee by the way when you were come forth out of Egypt, how he met thee by the way and smote the hindmost of thee, even all that were feeble behind thee, when thou wast faint and weary, and he feared not God. Therefore thou shalt blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Thou shalt not forget it. The significance of God's quarrel with Amalek was for all time, write this for a memorial in a book, but its effect would be the obliteration of Amalek as such. Thou shalt blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. It was a poor Israelite who failed to see more than the obvious literal meaning in this contrast, and missed the symbolical sense of the term Amalek. The law here, if only he could see it, was presenting a challenge to him to wage a relentless war against sin in himself and all about him, a war so relentless that sin would in the process be annihilated. Moses certainly construed the situation in that way, ranging himself symbolically on the side of God in the strife against sin and declaring his faith in its ultimate defeat. He built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi, that is, the Lord my banner. He perceived in the recent repulse of Amalek an earnest of the eventual destruction of sin itself, and added in explanation of the name which he had given to the altar, because the Lord hath sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Our own experience is proof that this is indeed so, for the spirit is in perpetual conflict with the flesh, these being contrary the one to the other. A generation later, this time at the end of the wilderness wandering and in actual sight of the promised land itself, there came to Israel a sobering reminder of the subtlety of the flesh and the deceitfulness of sin. Midian seduced Israel at Peor and brought disaster upon them in defiance of God. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Vex the Midianites and smite them, for they vex you with their wiles, wherewith they have beguiled you in the matter of Peor. The execution of that commission was to be Moses' last act before his death. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Avenge the children of Israel of the Midianites. Afterward shalt thou be gathered unto thy people. His orders as commander-in-chief are enlightening. And Moses spake unto the people, saying, Arm some of yourselves unto the war, and let them go against the Midianites, and avenge the Lord of Midian. But this general commission was to be carried out in a special way. Of every tribe 1,000 throughout all the tribes of Israel shall ye send to the war. We note the double emphasis. Each of the tribes was to be represented, and that equally. So there were delivered out of the thousands of Israel 1,000 of every tribe, 12,000 armed for war, and Moses sent them to the war, 1,000 of every tribe, them and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, to the war, with the holy instruments and the trumpets to blow in his hand. And they warred against the Midianites, as the Lord commanded Moses. The allegory is obvious. The 12,000 men who sallied forth to engage in battle with Midian symbolized the ideal Israel, warring for God in the spiritual struggle with the great adversary, sin, with all its wiles, of which Midian was but a type. At their head this time was a priest, equipped with trumpets, in conformity with legislation given some time subsequent to the battle with Amalek. The blasts which he would blow would symbolically represent the voice of Israel, uplifted in appeal for God's aid, the promise being, And ye shall be remembered before the Lord your God, and ye shall be saved from your enemies. And they were so saved on this occasion. The battle was not only won, but in the process not a man was lost out of the whole 12,000. There lacketh not one man of us, said the officers and captains after the roll was called. How telling a lesson was this? Surely, the record of that encounter should inspire the faithful of our day to fight with all confidence, assured of victory if relying upon God, and fearless of the dangers which beset them. That was certainly the spirit in which Israel were enjoined to fight. To do battle for God was a privilege demanding total sanctification of spirit. When the host goeth forth against thine enemies, then keep thee from every wicked thing. The soldiers' camp was to be a miniature of the camp around the tabernacle, and the host to regard itself as representative of the entire nation. As such, it had to be clean ceremonially, otherwise the type was marred. Uncleanness excluded from the encampment and meant the temporary forfeiture of covenant status, and so of the right to fight in this representative capacity. If there be among you any man that is not clean by reason of uncleanness that chanceth him by night, then shall he go abroad out of the camp. He shall not come within the camp, but it shall be when evening cometh on, he shall wash himself with water, and when the sun is down, he shall come into the camp again. The care demanded over sanitary arrangements was symbolic of God's demand for holiness in those who fought for him. Thou shalt have a paddle upon thy weapon, and it shall be when thou wilt ease thyself abroad, thou shalt dig therewith, and shalt turn back and cover that which cometh from thee. For the Lord thy God walketh in the midst of thy camp to deliver thee and to give up thine enemies before thee. Therefore shall thy camp be holy, that he see no unclean thing in thee turn away from thee. Failure to conform meant the loss of divine help. Or, to speak plain, God let it be understood that he helps only those who conform to his requirements. Holiness is his inexorable demand in his children. All else is hateful to him. If obedient, however, the host could fight with every assurance. The hazards of war were not to be dreaded, for the Exodus was historical proof of God's ability and willingness to help them. When thou goest out to battle against thine enemies, and seest horses and chariots and a people more than thou, be not afraid of them. For the Lord thy God is with thee, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. For the Lord your God is he that goeth with you, to fight for you against your enemies, to save you. Yet more was required than trust. Their service under arms, to be acceptable, had to be single-minded. God tolerated no half-heartedness in the spiritual warfare to which his people were called. Any preoccupation which might distract from fully devoted service, with property or wife, as well as personal safety, disqualified the warrior from the privilege of going into battle for God. Small wonder that a host so disciplined in spiritual matters was expected to conduct the war in the most humane and non-vindictive spirit. Only where their enemies brought judgment upon themselves as embodiments of sin, like the heathen of the land, or a presumption against God, like Amalek, was the utmost severity enjoined. Dull of soul indeed then were those Israelites who did not see the parabolic import of the Exodus story and its related legislation, each with its exacting moral claims to lay upon them. Dull of soul are we also, if we, in our turn, fail to perceive the same meanings in it, or to be sensible of the moral claims which the law still makes upon us. Our material circumstances are profoundly different from those of Israel in the wilderness, but not so our spiritual problems or our spiritual duty. Let us allow the law to remind us of that fact, lest we be guilty of Israel's folly and failure.